Jesus wore. Oh, when he wore. When Jesus wore. He washed my sins away. Happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to look at the latest on how to help our eyes, our heart, and our brain reverse aging and well, just be more functional, because a lot of people are having poor vision. Then we're going to take a look at some environmental issues, including what will air pollution do to the brain. Brand new research I'm going to share with you from the United Nations Environmental Project. And also, have you been hearing about polio-like illness sweeping across states? Could it be the vaccines? Vaxxer staff says yes. We'll explain that. Also, I have a guest in the second part of our program, and we're going to talk about why America is no longer affordable for the large majority of Americans with Elisa Quart. She is the executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which is a journalism project dedicated to reporting on inequality. So she'll be here to share that. And then we're going to continue with what we started on part one yesterday. We'll play about 10 minutes today of the left's abandonment of liberalism and the hypocrisy of some of the more radical fringe groups within the left that's eating it apart. Brendan O'Neill on that. So we have a lot to share, and I want to squeeze as much in as possible. We begin with a new study from Cornell University. This was published in Journal of Food Sciences, and they say that eating with your eyes, virtual reality can alter taste. What's that mean? Well, I just finished a retreat, and one of the most common feedback from everyone was, I didn't believe that vegan food could be this interesting, this beautifully presented. Many people there were vegans or vegetarians, but they're used just to making some brown rice and, you know, putting a scoop of it on a plate and then some beans, like you find in some of these simple platters in some of these macrobiotic restaurants. Very basic. Healthy, but still basic. Non-aesthetic. So we designed dishes. So every single dish, and we didn't repeat a single dish in 2 weeks, was a taste treat, but it also was an artistic experience. It was a piece of artwork. People would take their cell phones out and take pictures of these. And you could do it also. So eating with your eyes, what you visualize frequently will alter how something tastes. If something's very boring in how it's presented, we might consider just boring. We'll eat it because it's healthy, but it doesn't mean we really look forward to it. So humans not only relish the sweet and savory and saltiness of foods, but they are influenced by the environment in which they eat. And there's where Cornell University food scientists used virtual reality to show how people's perception of real food can be altered by their surroundings. Quote, when we eat, we perceive not only the taste and aroma of foods, we get sensory input from our surroundings. Our eyes, ears, even our memories about surroundings. So they took 50 panelists who used virtual reality headsets as they ate and were given three identical samples of blue cheese. The study participants were virtually placed in a standard sensory booth, a pleasant park bench, and the Cornell cow barn to see custom-recorded 360-degree videos. The panelists were unaware that the cheese samples were identical and rated the pungency of the blue cheese significantly higher in the cow barn setting than in the sensory booth or the virtual park bench. So let me put this a little another way. Let's say that you were going to eat in a standard cafeteria. Everything is boring, and there are a lot of people there. Now imagine taking the same identical food, but sitting on a park bench overlooking a pond in Central Park. It's the middle afternoon. It's quiet. It's pleasant. It's green. There's nature. You will perceive the food you're eating completely differently. And that's why I suggest don't turn on the television or the radio or sit in front of a computer and eat. And a lot of people do that. Very common. When you eat a meal, any meal, do it in a calm, nice environment, even your home or apartment. But put on some relaxing music, what you choose, and watch your perception of that meal. It'll change. From Oxford University, a balanced plant-based diet improves our health and the health of the planet. You know this, but evidently the people at Oxford didn't. This was published in the Lancet Planetary Health. A well-balanced, predominantly plant-based diet can lead to improved nutrition, reduce premature deaths from chronic diseases by more than 20%, and lower greenhouse gas emissions and fertilizer application in cropland and fresh water use. Globally, it does that, but also in every region of the world. The study, which was published, is the first to comprehensively assess the relationship between the health and nutritional impacts of different dietary change strategies and their environmental impacts across all major world regions. Quite simply, the food people eat impacts their health and the health of the environment. Unhealthy diets and overconsumption and hunger are leading to nutritional deficiencies and diet-related chronic diseases around the world. The food system is also a major cause for climate change and fresh water depletion and deforestation, and pollution of ecosystems, for example, through overapplication of fertilizers. So this is important. So if you go to a plant-based diet, you're not using all the chemicals that are used in factory farming. You're saving the lives of sentient creatures, the animals. You're not drawing a huge amount of water out of the aquifer for the animals. Let me give you an idea how bad it is. We need, depending upon how much we use, some Americans use about 120 gallons of water a day. That's really excessive. For example, yesterday, after putting in a lot of work, including with animals, and doing my workout, I simply got in a shower, shampooed down, showered down with 1 gallon of water. That's it. I was completely clean and then toweled off and ready to go. 1 gallon. To make brown rice takes a quarter of a gallon to make enough for 3 days. And it's always wise when you make a dish, whether it's beans or grain, make enough for 3 days. I don't believe we should be consuming it after that, but 3 days is fine. You save water. To grow a baked potato requires about 60 to 80 gallons of water. To have one single hamburger, requires 3,400 gallons of water. Yeah. And if you consider the whole 700-800-pound cow, you're looking at enough to float a boat. So imagine 80 gallons, hundreds of thousands of gallons, and then multiply that times 20 billion. And it shows you why we're running out of water in the United States. We're using it for animals instead of humans. So when you go vegan, the environmental impact will be huge. So high that it would be about 18% of the total global warming factor. Actually, a little more, because CO2, carbon dioxide, is not the same as methane. Methane can be anywhere from 20 to 60 times more powerful as a global warming cause. So we're saving the planet and we're saving our health by going towards a plant-based diet. I've been asked a gazillion times about wheat. And I've explained to people that you can do a simple cocoa pulse test to see whether or not you're allergic to the gluten in the wheat, the protein in it. And it's, what you do is in the morning, on an empty stomach, while still in bed, you take a simple amount of wheat. And you just put it under your tongue. You don't even have to swallow it. But you've taken your pulse before you've done that for 60 seconds. Wait in bed, don't get up, don't move around for 20 minutes. Now take your pulse again. If your pulse has gone up more than 5 beats a minute, let's say it was 70 when you first took it, then you put the wheat in the mouth, and 20 minutes later you took it again. If it's 75, there is a high probability you're allergic to that wheat. Now, if you're allergic, you lay off all wheat for 1 week. Have nothing that has wheat in it. Then a week later, take your pulse again, and then take a larger amount of the wheat, like eat a piece of bread. Now, if you're allergic to that, you're almost certainly going to have some symptoms. Your nose might stop up. You might have excessive mucus. You might have achingness in your joints. You might have some bloating. And then you know you're allergic to wheat. But a lot of people are not allergic to wheat, and it depends upon the quality of the wheat also. Some believe that because of the glyphosate that is sprayed on that, that you're allergic to the glyphosate, the chemical, not the wheat itself. That may be true. But Johannes Gutenberg University in Germany found that protein in wheat is pro-inflammatory, especially if you have chronic health conditions. So the scientists have once again confirmed that a protein in wheat triggers the inflammation of chronic health conditions like multiple sclerosis, asthma, rheumatoid arthritis, and contributes to the development of gluten insensitivity. So if you have any of these conditions, stay off wheat. All right? That'll make all the difference in the world. From the Polytechnic Institute of Branca in Portugal, they found that edible petals are a promising nutrient source. And they're bioactive, very high. So when we think of flowers, we think of that glam factor. But in point of fact, a lot of flowers are edible. And they have important nutritional characteristics and constitute a new source of bioactive compounds. And these are very rich in antioxidants, and they also have the unique taste. But you could go back in history. In the ancient Greek, Mesopotamian, and Roman empires, rose flowers, rosa, were used to prepare and puree omelets. In medieval France, the flowers of calendula, which is aficionados, were used to prepare omelets, but also salads. And they also were an accompaniment to cheese. And in Mexico, the dahlia flowers are commonly consumed in different types of dishes, for example, in the thick soups. So it's been used for a long time. There are at least 30 different edible flowers. Marigolds, of course, are also, and pansies are good. They're rich in carotenoids and antioxidants. So you're going to get the energetic value. You can actually get the organic acids, the tocopherols from the petals. And this was published in the Journal of Food Chemistry. So you can grow them yourself. And the best way of growing them, you can grow them in little sponges. because a sponge holds the water so they stay moist and they grow. And then, well, let me think, it would be about $100 a pound for these petals if you bought them on the market. And they sell them in little packages for like $6 to $10 each. But understand, 90% of what you're buying, even 95%, is the weight of the sponge that the little flower petals are in. So do it yourself. You can do it at home. Save a lot of money and have a lot of good nutrition. And also putting them in salads and decorating dishes. Also, the University of Leicester. Green leafy vegetables reduce diabetic risk. Another good study. So having your spinach, Swiss chard, collard greens, kale, mustard greens can help reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes. This was published in the British Medical Journal. And there was a team from the university, which is in central England. They reviewed six studies of over 220,000 people, and they looked at the link between fruit and vegetable consumption and type 2 diabetes. So eating just 1.5 extra servings of green leafy vegetables cut the risk of diabetes by 14%. But they're basing it upon very few people eating vegetables. I believe we should be eating 13 servings a day. Most people eat under two per day. And kids sometimes don't eat any. And that's why we now see these carbohydrate, sugar, fructose high diets, soft drinks diets, and kids with adult diabetes. In that same idea, University of Coimbra in Portugal found that a fruit-rich Mediterranean diet with antioxidants can cut AMD by more than a third. Now, AMD is a form of age-related macular degeneration, the leading cause of blindness. And this was based upon a presentation to the American Academy of Ophthalmology. So keep in mind that if you're juicing each day at least one glass of a high-quality green vegetable and one glass of a high-quality fruit, let's say you start off with watermelon, and you add some lemon, and you add some berries into that juice, and you have that at one time a day, and you have your green juice starting with celery and cucumber, then green apple, then all the others you want to add, but that's your base, you're going to protect your eyes. In fact, you're going to protect every part of your body because it's really terrific. And that's what this showed. And from the University of Leuven in Belgium, they found that spinach enhances strength and fitness. Why? Because spinach is rich in nitrates and beetroot, and those enhance sports performance. And you get more blood flow through the arteries and veins when you have the nitrate factor or the nitric oxide or the enhancement of oxygenation of the tissues. It's just good for you. And if you have a heart condition, wow. Every single person I know that I counsel has any heart condition, I make sure that they're having at least one full glass of beet juice every day. But now you can also add spinach into the beet juice. And for those of you who don't eat celery, think it's kind of boring. It isn't. According to Kurdistan University, which is actually in Iraq, celery has a very powerful healing quality to it. Well, we know it helps you lose weight. We know it's a natural diuretic, so people overweight are good to go on that. You get rid of a lot of the swelling in your legs and face, but it's rich in phenolic and antioxidant compounds, very rich, and therefore can help provide minerals to the body. And that, such as caffeic acid, C-A-F-F-E-I-C, and what is called cumaric acid, C-O-U-R-M-A-R-I-C, and apigenin, and lutein, and tannin, and saponin. These are all chemicals naturally occurring within celery, and they're all good for your body. So why would I eat celery? Because what I do each day, I take a celery stick, and you wash it. And by the way, for those of you who had cat bowls and dog bowls and bird bowls, I was watching a friend who has a dog not feeding him good food. That's wrong. And they feed him dry food, this kibble, which is junk, most of it. And then the canned food. If you wouldn't eat it, don't give it to your dog or cat. Because you have no idea how chemically embalmed this stuff is. If you want your cat and dog to live a long time, then you got to feed them living foods. But also how you clean the environment's important. For example, if you just think wiping it out with a paper towel, putting the food in again, or running some water over it, that doesn't do diddly squat. Could you imagine your surgeon coming in and his hands are dirty and he takes paper towel and just wipes them, then goes to open up your chest? I don't think so. So what you do is this. You get some healthy green detergent. You put detergent in there with just about a teaspoon of Clorox, a bleach, and you wipe it around until it's completely killed all bacteria, parasites, anything else, any mold, any virus, it'll kill it all. Then you rinse it. Then before you store it, take a paper towel, dampen it with alcohol, rubbing alcohol, and wipe it down again and leave it that way. Now you've got really sterile utensils or anything else you use. And always throughout the day, just take a wet paper towel of alcohol and wipe down doorknobs, refrigerators, toilets. People don't realize. You use the bathroom, you wipe yourself, you get up and you flush the toilet with the same hand sometimes that you wiped yourself, so there's feces all over your toilet plunger. And then you think you're clean. You're not. You're dirty. You got to wash with soap and water properly. And then you take alcohol and just wipe down the surface areas. Because if you go into, I did a lot of flying this weekend, especially since flights were delayed and I got on four different flights, all of which were canceled. Finally, I decided to fly into another town and just rent a car and take it where I needed to go. And every time you go to the restroom, you see people coming out of a stall, and they go over and their hands are filthy, and they use their hands to put the faucet on, and then after they wash their hands, they take that same clean hand and turn the water off. Is there some it's amazing how people are so lacking hygiene in America. But we do. We're a dirty country. We really are. I go to other countries, they're far, far more sophisticated in hygiene than we are, for yourself and animals. Anyhow, one day I'll just do a program on how you keep animals healthy and living a longer life. By the way, my auntie is now hitting 33, and to my knowledge, unless someone can show me otherwise, she's the longest living ring-tailed lemur in the world, and healthy as can be, happy. I got her over her arthritis that she developed when my caretaker, who's no longer here because of this, some years ago, didn't follow my feeding directions. Unfortunately, that happens. And it took me about 3 months, completely reversed her paralysis. And now she's moving around like she's 1 year old. And she was rescued. They're all rescues. So, still alive, that gives me great joy of seeing a creature that can live that long. But you take a look. I had a film. I have a security camera. So I'd ask Glenn, my IT person, can he hook up the internet to my security camera so people can actually watch how I feed all the animals every day? Because when people come in, they're blown away. First of all, as one guy said this morning, I don't know anyone in America that eats this healthy. because every single thing is fresh, it's organic, it's washed, the place is sterilized. You're talking about clean. Yeah. And the water, pure water, even for the horses, the donkeys, 5 gallons for each one, pure spring water every day. And so people drink coffee, poison, drink alcohol, poison, eat sugar, poison, eat refined carbohydrates, poison, eat fried foods, poison, and then wonder, God, why did I got high blood pressure? Why I got arthritis? Well, because, fool, you worked on it. So we ought to have every day in America, we ought to have an Academy Awards for foolish behavior, self-inflicted wounds. Now, getting back to celery, I'll take an avocado, and we should have an avocado a day. And I dice up sweet onions. Then I put some chili peppers in there, jalapeno. Depending upon your tolerance is what you put in. I squeeze the juice of 2 lemons into it and 1/2 teaspoon of mustard, stone ground mustard. I blend it all together into a pate and then put that into this celery. Now, that's a different type of celery. So what's the celery do? Why should we have celery every single day? A, because it helps fight inflammation. It contains apigenin, APA, A-P-I, genin, G-E-N-I-N, which according to, read Molecular Nutrition and Food Research. It shows it reduces inflammation and restores your immune balance. And this particular molecule is also being studied for its anti-cancer properties. It lowers blood pressure. Every single person I've counseled who has high blood pressure, I'm going to guess that's about 45 to 50 million people worldwide, or excuse me, in America, who's written me or who's been, excuse me, not million, 50,000, who's written me and asked about high blood pressure, I say celery juice every day. With lemon and celery and beet together, you can lower your blood pressure real quick. But also, it prevents cancer. Why? Because celery contains lutein, L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N. It's a flavonoid, and it possesses anti-cancer properties. In fact, there's a study in the Journal of Current Cancer Drug Targets that they found the association between cancer and celery. Celery also helps reduce hyperlipidemia, which is a condition that occurs when there is an increase in fatty molecules in the blood. And this increases the long-term risk of heart disease and stroke. And research has shown that celery extract reduces the amount of bad cholesterol, and that's good. And one last one, celery supports neurogenesis. Now, neuro, N-E-U-R-O, genesis, G-E-N-E-S-I-S. And why do I spell all the time, every day? Because we have a lot of people around the world. I mean, mind you, we're all over the world. This is the number one progressive radio program on the entire planet by a huge margin. So when people listen, they don't all speak English. It's not their first language. And I get saying, I couldn't understand what you were saying. Could you spell it? So to help people better understand, people take notes. I spell things. That's why some people say, why do you spell things? Well, because people want to get the information. And apigenin that I mentioned earlier will promote neurogenesis or the growth and development of nerve cells. And apigenin also improves learning and memory. So multiple sclerosis, cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, absolutely have to have this. Also, it helps with gout, muscle spasms, the flu and colds, and water retention. That's it for today on Health Nutrition. We are 30 minutes into our program, halfway through. We're going to take a break and come back. And I'm going to play a little Brendan O'Neill. I think we need to hear that because people are confused. People assume that Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Rachel Maddow represent liberals. They do not. There is nothing liberal I can find in. They represent corporate democratic interest. They're corporatists. They're part of the neoliberal. Neoliberal. That means the people who, their mantra and their moniker is control and power, hegemony. So the real left, the left that many of us have supported and grown up with, we have distanced ourselves. They do not speak for us. We want nothing to do with them. They are corrupt, in our opinion, my opinion. So a fearless fighter for freedom is Brendan O'Neill. Agree or disagree with him, we're going to go to part two, and then after that, our guest.
Kind of culture we need to cultivate.
Yeah, is there a doubly difficult problem here? Because also we don't know what's going on with the algorithms that these companies make. So publicly they could say we're for free speech,
we're for
all these things, but actually they might be writing in code that could, you know, stop some of my subscribers from seeing videos, or putting me aside, could, you know, wipe out people's Twitter accounts or whatever else. It's like we actually don't know now the math.
Yes.
Behind how people get information.
Unquestionably, that happens. And I don't have a Twitter account, but I sometimes look at Twitter. You can't live in the modern sphere without looking at it and seeing what people are talking about on there. And what amazes me, if you look at Twitter stories, for example, or the things that Twitter emphasizes, it's always stuff that goes along with the Twitter mindset, with
always.
The Silicon Valley mindset, with that kind of fairly mainstream conformist mindset now. You know, they emphasize if Twitter has a kind of intersectional outburst and it attacks someone for being sexist or misogynist or racist and so on, often overblown accusations, Twitter will emphasize that, upfront it, and turn it into the daily story. So Twitter undoubtedly has an editorial input and control. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, you want to say, fine, that's you can do that. But then they've got to stop calling themselves the free speech wing of the free speech party, because increasingly they do appear like a publication, which just happens to let other voices chip in every now and then.
So basically what I'm sensing from you is that there really is no good answer here yet, right? Because what you're saying is you want them to self-police. You don't want the government to come in. You want them to be transparent. But you don't want to use force to make that happen.
Right.
So there really is no answer that we can walk away from and be like, well, all right, that's the sensible way to deal with it.
There's no
the idea that you're talking about that I like, the personal responsibility of the individual and the company. But that's sort of separate from what actually happens when the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, there's no easy answer except that we should defend freedom of speech every single time it's under attack, whether that's in the academy, on some informal part of campus, in relation to the government, in social media, in the press. Wherever freedom of speech is under attack, we should defend freedom of speech, and we should defend it for the very simple reason that everyone should be allowed to say what they want to say. And everyone else, this is the part of freedom of speech that people forget, because they always say, oh, you're defending free speech for horrible people. The second, even more important part of freedom of speech is defending the right of the audience to decide for themselves what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
And that's the most important part, because the problem with censorship, of course, is that it infantilizes people. It tells you don't have to think. We will think for you. We will decide for you. And that really weakens people's moral muscles, weakens their intellectual muscles, encourages them to be childlike and infant-like and to never think about the world.
Yeah, it directly feeds outrage culture, actually.
It feeds a very simplistic reading of the world, a very childish reading of the world, and it dumbs down culture. Censorship is a far greater threat to intellectualism and peace and liberty and all those things we think are good than freedom of speech ever could be. So it's important to always defend freedom of speech in every sphere. And through doing that, I think we might eventually encourage people rather than forcing them to protect freedom of speech within the spheres in which they operate.
Yeah. Do you think we're getting some wins right now? I mean, you're doing a tour with a bunch of people from Brett Weinstein and Laura Kipnis and Steven Pinker and a whole bunch of people in this space. And, you know, I'm doing the college thing too. And obviously Spiked is working. This show is working. Other people in this space, it's all working. Do you think we're actually starting to win here? I'm hopeful as a human.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an optimist.
Yeah.
Otherwise I couldn't do this. But there's so much bad stuff, it's hard to place it.
I veer between optimism and pessimism, and which are both valuable emotions, as it happens. Optimism is good because you feel buoyant and you want to go out and fight in the world. And pessimism is good because it makes you reflect and think, well, what's going wrong? So I don't have a problem with either of those takes, but I flip between the two. On the one hand, I'm optimistic because I see lots of young people, and on this tour that Spiked is doing, the Unsafe Space tour, where we're going to campuses and... What we're trying to do, in fact, is move away from the pantomime debates that have been taking place on campus in recent years, where some member of the so-called alt-right will come in and irritate all the feminists and the idiots in the audience, and then they will, you know, the alt-right gets a kick because they wind everyone up, and then the audience members get a kick because they get to shout fascist at people they don't like.
Right, and it's then all you do is strengthen the extremes.
You strengthen the extremes, and it's all heat and no light. And it's entertaining, and everyone watches it on YouTube, and it gets hundreds of thousands of hits, but no one learns anything. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do with this tour is go onto campuses and convince people using hopefully intellectual rigor and substantial historical arguments and clever people that freedom of speech is the most important value in a civilized society. And in fact, civilized society is not possible without it. So we're trying as best as we can to lift the discussion away from the rather pantomime black and white unhelpful clash that it's become, the culture war that it's become, to explain the origins of freedom and the importance of freedom. And I'm optimistic because we're having a good reception. And I'm meeting young people in New York and Washington and other places in America who are really, really keen on freedom of speech, but feel like they don't have a place in which they can say how keen they are on freedom of speech.
Yeah.
So I'm optimistic in that sense. I'm pessimistic in the sense that I fear that the argument for freedom is being colonized by people on the right who I don't think are always 100% convincing in their defense of freedom. And the thing that particularly worries me now is the left's abandonment of the ideal of freedom. I think that's actually the real crisis we face in Western societies now, which is that the left and so-called liberals, and you know, the word liberal is about the word liberty, are turning their backs on liberty. That's a real problem.
Yeah, okay, so I really want to dive deep into this one because everyone watching this, at least my...
I also would share some of Brendan's thoughts when it comes to being optimistic for those who have shown by their own fortitude that they're willing to make change. They're not looking at insurmountable objects in their life, whether it's on diet and getting their health back, which sometimes can mean that they will be challenged by their own family members, especially if the family thinks that they're going to an extreme. Well, death is the ultimate extreme. And suffering and pain, disability, and some form of diminishment of quality of life is an extreme. Taking 3 glasses of vegetable juice a day is then perceived as a greater extremity and more frightening, creating more emotional discomfort than what that juice could do to overcome these. Believe it or not, I've heard those arguments, just heard them last week. I can't get too healthy because my family would be in effect traumatized. I actually hear these arguments. So I'm optimistic of what I know can happen in a society where we exercise freedom in a responsible way by stepping back and looking non-judgmentally at everything we have to put into this puzzle so it is a complete picture versus reacting to everything out of ideological programming. And that's what I see currently. I've seen that in the right for a long time. I see it now on the left, and it's disappointing. When Pacifica's KPFA censors repeatedly programming that is meant that it's a non-political program. It's meant to help provide people with insights and information that could possibly save someone's life. And that's deemed threatening, and they censor it. So this whole nonsense, and also this is just a word of advice for those who want to see the local stations, the five local stations, succeed. At some point, you're going to have to allow someone who's an adult into the room, whether it's a station manager, a program director, a developmental director, a human resource person, a board that actually has qualifications to raise money, can write checks, and has big Rolodexes, and has professional background and non-commercial. None of that exists anywhere in Pacifica right now. None of it. And also, this is not the 1960s, but there's been a hybrid of that old mindset plus the victimization mindset. I'll tell you what the average American doesn't want to hear today: whining, complaining about everything, blaming everyone, taking no responsibility for the hubris you've engaged in and the outcome. And yet, look around. You want to see someone who's failing right now, big time? Michael Moore. Look at what he used to do. He used to had the number one, number two, number three all-time grossing commentaries on social issues. Not now, because he's become purely ideologue, 100%. A Hillary supporter, not looking at the larger issues, nor holding her responsible for all the crimes against humanity that her and Obama engaged in. So when you galvanize yourself to a victim mindset, you're going to alienate yourself from the vast majority of people. And it doesn't matter what their political stripes are. You've alienated yourself. Just something to remember, why some people succeed and others continue to fail miserably, including Pacifica in its entirety. Let's go over and say hello now to Elisa Quart, Quart. I mentioned her bio earlier. She's executive director and of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which is a journalism project dedicated to reporting on inequality. Her essays have appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, New York Review of Books, and she also writes a bi-monthly column for The Guardian called Outclassed. She's a graduate of Columbia University School of Journalism, was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard, and has taught at SUNY New Paltz and Columbia. And her website is alissaquart.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you, Gary.
The theme I really want to address is the continual rise of financial insecurity for a growing number of Americans, particularly the middle class or the working class, even the professional class now. Because what I've seen, and this has not been reported, but I've surmised this based upon a lot of interviews, hundreds of interviews, including friends of mine who are money managers. And even the professional class is up to its eyeballs in debt. You would never know from the outside. You would see these kind of new gilded age homes, co-ops, high-end lifestyles, and they're having to work 16-hour days, constantly stressed, because on the inside, they've lost all sense of financial propriety, and their families are just as bad. So even if one of the professionals says, we can't afford this lifestyle anymore, everyone gangs up on him saying, but, and that but says, if you really love us, you'll let us continue to buy crap we don't need, spend money that you can't afford, and the stress is on you. It's epidemic. In any case, when you look at our increasing health care, in fact, insurance premiums are going up again. Housing is up. Child care and education are expensive. Taxes on purchases for practically everything is rising. We criticize the amount of taxes other nation citizens pay to have universal health care and quality education. But after we add up all the other various costs Americans pay, these other nations' populations are better off than we are. They do not have the debt. They have quality in all social services, and more families survive from paycheck to paycheck here. I could take you to Sweden. I could take you to Switzerland, Norway, Finland, and ask the average person, not a rich person, the average person, how much savings do you have? And it'll go anywhere from 10 to 30%. Ask the average American, including the average professional. It's 5% for high-end earners, to -2% for the average person. So when you're surviving paycheck to paycheck, barely having enough savings to get this past month's rent, and you're always living in a crisis, what do you do? And especially if you're a careerist. I know careerists who are now are Uber drivers. Yet this has been a trend going on for several decades. It's just now, since the Great Recession of 2008, it's showing itself. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right when you say all these other developed countries have a safety net that is missing for families in America, you know. In Canada, and this is not, you know, I hesitate to say Sweden and Finland because people sneer. They go, oh, Scandinavian countries. But Canada, our neighbor, not that different from us. They have universal government-subsidized daycare for children ages 4 and under at the cost of $7 to $20 per day. So that means that I spent an evening with two Montreal-based scholars in their 20s, and I understood how this underemployed twosome already had two children. So different from New York. And that's not the only thing. You know, in Quebec, the state maternity and paternity leave insurance gives a parent up to 75% of his or her salary and covers like 15 to 18 weeks for the mother and 3 to 5 weeks for the father. Now, if we contrast that to family leave in America, which covers 14%, paid family leave covers 14% of the population, and often it's a minuscule, number of weeks. So one of the things I was trying to write about in Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, was all of these pressures, the way that we've normalized America's neglect for families. You know, it's a constant refrain, you know, when I talk about my book, when I write about it, I'll get these commenters, you know, many commenters or people who are, or people writing letters to me are writing, God, this is my life. You know, I've been a partially employed academic. I'm a firefighter who lost their job or who had an injury. And now I'm, you know, my husband has cancer and, you know, on and on, right? But then I'd also get these emails from, oh, you expect the state to take care of everything. Stop your whining. You know, why are you demanding maternity leave? We don't have the money for that as a country. And then I say, like, look at these other countries. I mean, America is, like, equivalent to 8 Southern Pacific islands. I mean, seriously, it's something like, you know, Papua New Guinea and a bunch of Southern Pacific islands that have no national paid leave, right? That's our company. You know, this is not, you know, only Sweden. It's Greece. It's, you know, more mundane countries.
There are millions of young adults who have now graduated from college with huge debts hanging over them. Mm-hmm. They entered college expecting that they would get a decent job and would make them socially mobile, lead into the middle class or higher, and they expected to own their own homes, eventually have a family and raise children, give them an education. But that entire scenario has remained a myth of the American dream. It's now pure illusion, except for lucky ones. You call huge segments of our disenchanted population the middle family. The system is then a threat to them. Explain this phenomena. How work and occupation has now become antagonistic to having a family and children?
Yeah, well, you know, I think I write somewhere in the book, you know, America's now a country where you go to school until you have debt, work until you go to sleep, and have a family for a family you don't even get to see. So it's sort of kind of a recipe for miserableism that's kind of overwork and debt. And there's 1.5 trillion dollars in student debt in this country, and the average, I forget what the average debt is for individuals, but it's considerable for individuals of all ages, from, you know, 40 and 50 year olds too, not just people in their 20s. And one thing I saw when I was reporting were people in their 50s who had their own student debt for either undergraduate or graduate school, and then they were paying their kids college educations and accruing debt for their kids. So it's almost like this new kind of debt. And I call this whole thing the middle precariat. And what I mean by that is people who are middle class, but they are precarious. They, You know, they're living check to check, like some of the people you described. They're not sure that they're going to be able to pay for their kids' school. Their kids are not sure they're going to be able to pay off their debt for school, and on and on. And all this is in a moment where there is indeed low unemployment numbers. But the point I'm trying to make in Squeezed is things like debt and overwork and quality of life are not really affected by those numbers.
Well, are you aware of how many major corporations are now closing shop or closing up stores? Subway is closing up 500 stores. And you start looking at the equity partners who have bought these corporations. None of these companies are able to sustain themselves because they're all under heavy debt. And no one's asking, what can we do to help these people? Why can't we put a moratorium on purchasing these companies? Because the companies by themselves, Linen Things, Circuit City, Toys R Us, they would have all survived. They'd be working today and have millions of people employed, but they were purchased by these economic parasites, the lowest of the low in our society, and yet they're helded because they're $1 billion and how much they can write to universities, endowments, PBS. And they sanitize these terrible reputations. I call them economic genocidalists. And so right now, where some corporations are thriving, I see at least 70 major corporations closing up, malls closing up, and the middle class just being completely left out of this. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is, you know, you have automation and online shopping taking the place of a lot of things that, you know, if you remember, though, we used to hate malls. Like, we thought they were, you know, a scourge in the 80s and 70s. There were songs parroting them, you know, Valley Girl, stuff like that. But now they seem like the town square, right, in some communities. It's like the place where young people can meet, and the tragedy is actually the loss of these kind of spaces. So, but back to the top CEOs and these giant corporations that are, you know, riding high on debt, they're also overpaying their, you know, upper echelons, right? And that's part of the explanation for their debt. You know, top CEOs made 312 times what typical workers made in 2017. So the debt is not accidental. you know, but it doesn't affect the wealthiest people in this country. Their CEO pay rose to $19 million on average in that year, while your normal worker's pay is rising 0.3%.
Wow. Let me give you a few companies that I feel are going to go bankrupt or lay off a total of hundreds of thousands of employees. JCPenney, it's bankrupt. Macy's, J. Crew, Sears, 39 of stores are closing again. You have Abercrombie, Sam's Club, Kmart, Michael Kors, Foot Locker, Crocs, Claire's, Mattress Firm, Gap, Best Buy, Tom, Bonton, The Children's Place, Tavana, Subway, Rite Aid. I don't think people are aware of how serious it is because they're not into this. They're not looking at the real numbers. They're unfortunately, they have been told time and again how wonderful everything is because of look at Wall Street, and Wall Street is not good. One thing we never talk about in our society is the professional class. They're broke. They are buying, but they're buying with every penny they make. So if they make $1 million a year as a heart surgeon, they're spending $1 million. If they're making $200,000 as a lawyer, they're spending $200,000. And we don't talk about how we have tried to make debt into an asset. And that's economic
alchemy.
Yeah,
well, it's been normalized. Debt has been normalized. So this is something that really fascinates me. I was thinking about, you know, the great 19th century novels. You know, remember from English class, House of Mirth, Dickens novels. Many characters, Crime and Punishment, right, they're in debt. But they're in debt because something really went wrong. It was a very, you know, exceptional situation. They fell into penury. They were existential anti-heroes, right? Now if you're in debt, you're like a normal person in this country. I mean, I talked to this family who were in their early 40s, and their entry-level paycheck at the job they were working was $36,000 per year, but they were $400,000 in debt for the cost of their legal educations. So they were very unlikely to be paying this back, and they were carrying it around, and the psychological weight of the debt, in addition to the economic weight. And, you know, in German, the word for debt is the same as the word for guilt. And I think that's, you know, there's a shame in it. And part of my book is to say, look, if everybody has this debt now, and it's being produced by a system that's problematic and out of whack, why should you, student debtor, feel ashamed? You know, you're normal. And when we talk about professions that are struggling, let's focus on law here because I mentioned it. You know, the average law school debt in 2014 was $112,000. And in all these different states, when these graduates try to get a job, they're considered, and I love this phrase, it's horrible, excess attorneys in different states. You know, 56% of those with a law degree in Alaska can't get work as lawyers, for instance. That's a huge number. And in Tennessee, it's something like 53%. And they're all called excess attorneys.
Well, I want to close with this thought. Have you read Mishra's book, The Age of Anger?
Pankaj Mishra?
Yeah, Pankaj Mishra's book.
Yeah, I love his work. I haven't read it. Should I read it? I love fiction.
Read it. Yeah. It's really great. Good because it documents
really
how
it
documents how our postmodern world has done little but dish out completely disingenuous promises, and instead more and more people feel left behind or pushed away. And this has resulted in the eruption of intense hatred and horrifying blame game. And people think they can recreate an imaginary golden age and make America great again illusion. But trying to uphold these phantoms only makes things worse. There is no golden age to return to. There never has been one. And with the climate change, it is only going to get increasingly more dystopian and violent. But anger is energy, and energy can accomplish many constructive things. So I believe that we should be using anger constructively, not destructively, and making the changes that bring us all out of our suffering, those who are suffering. I also recommend people read your newest book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. I want to thank you, Alisa, for being on today.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Alisa Quart, Quart. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.